Welcome to another episode of Code for Thought.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. Make It Sing is today's episode about music and software. And I have three very exciting guests in here who are now going to introduce themselves. Maybe we can start with you, Emily.
My name's Emily Howard, and I'm a composer. I'm based at the Royal Northern College of Music. I'm the director of PRISM. It's the centre there for it's the RSM Centre for Practice and Research in Science and Music.
Chris, could you introduce yourself?
I'm Chris Meelan, and I'm PRISM's research software engineer. I have to get that in the right order. Oh, I do struggle with it.
That was right.
Yeah, I write lots of software. I'm a composer as well, which is an interesting combination. I did study music initially. I did a PhD in composition. Then I worked for 10 years in basically in industry, but came back to work on a project called the John Cage Cage Concert Project, which was an investigation of John Cage's concert for piano and orchestra from 1958. And then I joined PRISM.
And finally, David.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. I'm Dave Durer. I'm one of the co-founders of PRISM. I'm the technical director of PRISM, and I'm based in Oxford, also at the Alan Turing Institute, which I think, as people will know, is the UK National Institute for Data Science and AI. I'm a Turing Fellow, and my project there is focused on AI and music.
Well, AI and music, that's something we're going to talk about in more detail. Software and music are certainly no strangers, although they haven't been for quite some time. And we have electronic music, we have music editing software. But maybe the listeners would like to know how it fits in with research, and how does the Royal Northern College of Music and your work, David, in Oxford, fit into all of this with music and software?
I'll respond to that, Peter, and then I think maybe Chris could comment about music and software as well and algorithmic composition. But just to set the big picture, obviously sound has been generated by computers since the really early days of electronic computers, since the 1950s. And now, of course, fast forward to today, studios are digital, but the software is used right through that production chain, from composing and performing the music through to mixing and distribution and consumption, and then collecting data from what we play. So software is right through the piece. Hardware is also now really good at digital audio, so this has democratized the whole access to digital music creation and consumption. So it's, you know, software is absolutely part of this. Every aspect of that leads to research. And I should say, one of the great things about working in music, and I'm an interdisciplinary researcher, is that it just touches on so many disciplines, because it is music and it's maths and it's physics and it's electronics and it's signal processing and it's social science and it's humanities. It's the whole piece. So it's a really, really exciting area for me. I wonder if Chris wanted to comment on the use of software in actually creating music.
Well, I've been doing that myself since I finished my PhD. Well, the last year of my PhD, I started to use software from Earcom, Open Music, which maybe some of your listeners have heard of, which is computer-assisted composition software. I had to pay for it then. These days it's free. It was very expensive. So I've been using that. That was actually written in Lisp. I saw it as a kind of extension, particularly using Lisp. Lisp is a very dynamic language, and I find it quite similar to writing music. Writing code is, to me, quite a similar experience. I mean, I don't use any of the kind of bondage and discipline languages, as they're called, you know, the C++s of this world and Java. So I don't use those. I'm mostly Lisp, JavaScript, Python. So I'm writing in a way that is very dynamic and very kind of almost like improvisation. It's something I've done ever since. I tried to find a job doing that, but I failed, which is why I ended up in industry. I don't know where I saw this, that the computer is the particle accelerator of the humanities. And I think that's a particularly nice way of encapsulating it.
Well, thanks to Chris and Dave for, I mean, from my perspective, I come from a background in mathematics and computer science, an undergraduate degree, and also studying music. So for me, software and music have always come together, but in quite an unusual manner. I'd say that perhaps my route into thinking about software and thinking is more theoretical often, and thinking about algorithm design and thinking about applying algorithm design to acoustic pieces of music and the methods behind that. I think what happened was that maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, I was speaking with the founders of Prism. So that's David de Roo and also Marcus de Sotoy, mathematician Marcus de Sotoy. We applied for a grant, Research England, expanding it's E3, Expanding Excellence in England, Research England grant, to expand Prism at the RNCM. And one of the key things about this was we wanted to appoint a research software engineer, and we appointed Chris Meelan. And this is the first research software engineer position in, I think, in a UK conservatoire. I mean, I don't know the complete stats everywhere, but I think, and it's a really important place to be, and very exciting. To give some examples, this year, so undergraduate composers work, and postgraduate composers, working closely with Chris, developing their pieces in collaboration. These students have gained so much from this dialogue about their work and sending ideas across, sending audio files across, receiving different information back. It's kind of a very exciting time for the Royal Northern College of Music and also for Prism.
One thing that came up that I would like to follow up on was democratization. And I wonder if you could actually indulge us a little bit by what you mean by that. How does that software music combination democratize? Well, what does it actually democratize? What do you mean by that? Maybe, David, you started the phrase for the first time, so maybe I pick you first as a victim.
For a long time, access to studio quality recording has required access to a physical, back in the analog days, a physical studio, and the equipment was expensive. And to get high-end quality, you'd pay a lot of money for that studio time, and obviously expertise that's involved with it as well. One of the things that's changed, and obviously there's still a lot of value in going into a studio, one of the things that's changed is that you can create music to that quality in your bedroom, in your house, in your home studio, in your shed. We're at the point now where the computers we're using, the laptops we're using, are absolutely capable of really high quality work. It's really that greater accessibility of the music technology and all the software tools that have come with it. It's a really rich set of tools, obviously depending on the kind of music you want to create, that's available. It's easier to enter this world. I wouldn't want to suggest that you shouldn't go to studios as well, particularly for the expertise in the production process.
I mean, it is the case that in general, software development over the last 20 years, maybe 30, has become democratized through the internet. I mean, you know, software is now much more readily available to everybody. From the point of view of the kind of thing that we are doing, we're doing a lot of machine learning stuff. And certainly even 10 years ago, that was something that was pretty much exclusive. But over the last 10 years, you've seen an explosion of interest and availability of machine learning, AI tools. It's really exploded. And the thing is that really, you know, anybody can do it, but there are some obstacles as well, because, you know, if you want to do it properly, you have to have access to a certain type of kit. You know, you need GPUs. I mean, democratization, whether the quality of there's just so much stuff out there, and then it becomes harder to filter through that, doesn't it, I suppose. So, yeah, be careful what you wish for. It has its benefits, but it has its drawbacks as well, as with everything in technology.
What do you say, Emily?
I think it's really difficult. I don't know, when we say democratizing, if we're using AI and we're using the internet and 70% of what is on the internet is Chopin, what are we doing? You know, that's a problem. Maybe that's more of an ethical problem. You know, are we saying that then if we're creating huge data sets and just trawling mindlessly, then actually we're creating a canon, or we're even magnifying a canon to some extent of what is already out there. And I just wonder whether, well, we just have to be careful about that, I think.
We're not the only kind of group that's working on contemporary music, obviously, and technology. They have gone hand in hand for a long time, but we're certainly using certain software, you know, neural synthesis, contemporary music, or quote unquote contemporary classical music, you know. Yeah, as Emily says, if everything is just Chopin and Beethoven, not that there's anything wrong with Chopin and Beethoven, very good composers.
but there are others. There are others too.
They have their good quality. Let's make rooms for something else, something different. There's so much crossover these days as well. That's the other thing it's opened up. It's democratized stuff, but it's also opened up naturally, because if you're using technology, you can use it for anything. You know, just as the piano got used in jazz as much as it's used in classical music, you know, technology has more of an effect in that sense. I think it tends to be more widely used. I mean, look at something like Max MSP, or Max as it's called these days, is mostly used by EDM dance, you know, kind of pop, pop musicians, where it was produced at EarCam, you know, High Flute in Contemporary Music Institute, you know, many years ago.
I think it's a brilliant discussion. Because on the one hand, yes, this democratization we discussed does enable the creativity, and that's fundamental to this. But I think your point about Chopin is brilliant, Emily, because if you just look at the overall music ecosystem, we're also putting sort of positive feedback loops into that, where certain types of music are getting, as you suggested, sort of amplified. It's amazing how many pieces of sort of early AI work with machine learning and composers has chosen Bach to start with. There's a real risk that actually we're reinforcing, you know, the Western canon. We really do need to make sure that it broadens out from that as well. I think that's an excellent point.
Talking of AI in music now, part of the prism is Sampler RNN, which is, I think, a machine learning toolbox for music. Maybe, Chris, I mean, you've been working on this for a while. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a background. And ultimately, yeah, I would like to hear some samples, but we come to that in a minute.
So Sample RNN, Prism Sample RNN. I should add that we didn't originate it. It was originally published, the original architecture was proposed in a paper in 2016. So when I joined Prism, colleague composer Sam Salem, really wanted to use this particular implementation of the architecture. And unfortunately, we could not get it to work because the code, I mean, that's one of the problems in machine learning and AI projects in general. A lot of the code gets deprecated very quickly. And we found this with the original version of it. We wrote our own. We re-implemented it. We have modifications, so it's not exactly the same. So to kind of define it broadly, it's neural synthesis. So it's using neural networks to generate raw audio samples from a data set of raw audio samples. So it's not symbolic in any way. It's not using a score, either a MIDI score or an actual musical score in the conventional sense. It's WAV files. So it's training on those large data sets. Now that has its challenges in itself. One of the big problems is, where do you get lots of WAV files? And one of the things we've discovered is that these things really need a lot of data. We've been developing this for the last, since the beginning of Prism, really. It's become a kind of flagship project, certainly on the machine learning side of things. There is another thing I should mention, actually, in the context of Sample RNN, is your listeners might have heard of the DataBots, who use the original version of the code to build a streaming YouTube channel, which generates AI death metal forever, which is interesting. It's called something Doppelganger, Persistent Doppelganger, or something like that. The DataBots are interesting. They're a duo. It's research. You know, my particular interest in it is research and developing it. Because one of the things that a lot of music AI software finds difficult is modeling long-range structures, large-scale kind of forms.
Like musical segments or sort of parts of a...
Yeah, you do get that. Yeah. Perhaps we'll discover that in a few moments when we play an excerpt. It produces quite impressive results. But long-range kind of structures are what I'm really interested in. Perhaps, yes, we could play an excerpt, if you like. We trained it on the 32 Beethoven piano sonatas a while back.
Months ago.
We did that because it's science again, isn't it? You know, the original paper that introduced Sample RNN did this. So I wanted to repeat it. Weirdly, some of it sounds like Stockhausen, but I don't know.
Oh, well, I'd like to hear that.
I don't want to Stockhausen Verlag, but there you go.
Yeah.
But it's public, you know, the original audio file is public domain.
Why would I want to use AI in music, in composition, Emily? Because you're a composer, and how does that actually help you?
I'll speak about my process, because I imagine and I know it's extremely different for different types of composers. So for me, coming to this for the first time, I was very excited to be observing this software growing all year. At times, Chris would bring it along and there'd be little tests of something happening. I had a commission for the Young Piatti String Quartet, an amazing string quartet, and I was to write them a piece around about 10 to 15 minutes of acoustic music. And the idea was that I wanted to find a way to bring in using this AI software in the compositional process. Of course, we were heavily hampered by lockdown and all manner of things last year, but I did manage, the Piattis did visit the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester in September, and I had spent the summer writing sketches. So what I'd done is I've written string quartets before. I've got a couple of them. One's called Afferents, another one's called Four Musical Proofs and a Conjecture. And I selected a couple of moments that I really love from my earlier works. And I took a piece from that, Conjecture. You could hear it. Maybe we could even hear a bit of that at some point, Conjecture.
Yes. Yeah.
What I wanted to do was I wanted to feed in these moments into the data set or have them recorded by the Piattis alongside some new materials. Usually when I make something, I suppose I'm making it for a performance rather than it being a sort of making it so that it can be recorded so that it can then be used as a data set. And that was just a really interesting process because I suppose it changed the type of materials I made. I made three different types of materials, very repetitive, kind of loopy and very obsessive materials. Sort of, I'm deeply interested in making scores that are like making algorithmic processes that expand and contract in as many different musical parameters that I can think of. So that's right. What these pieces did in very irregular ways. So I spoke with Chris regularly. Chris was trying to work out ways to chunk this material because there wasn't necessarily a lot of it. I think there might have been an hour. And at some point I wanted just the material we used.
So the last year, I mean, we started working together, Emily and myself, last September, October. It was around that time that, you know, our collaborative work with Sample RNN started and also started working with some students as well. So I developed a workflow, well, just to kind of fill in some of the details. So what you give Sample RNN, you know, is a data set. You have your original audio, which may be in the form of a file. So it processes batches of these files. So it's not processing the entire thing in one go. So it's slicing it up into small chunks. So you have a lot of these, you know, several thousand, hopefully. But we didn't have that many in that case. And so that was part of the learning process of learning, basically, that we need a lot of data.
Chris trained things and they did or didn't work. And then I would feed back and then he would tweak. I asked him, because the piece was actually meant to be about 12 minutes, and I asked him to produce a track of about 12 minutes rather than a sort of 30-second chunk, because I just wanted to hear the overall form. The ones I liked best sort of were incredibly extreme. They were, I'm just going to read something from the score. It alternated between this. It's a constant, unfocused sound, sometimes strained, sometimes thick and fuzzy, sometimes grainy, always shifting subtly and unpredictably in texture. Each player should execute frequent bow changes, incorporating occasional, almost imperceptible glitch sounds alongside sudden and wild changes in vibrato, speed and frequency. Just for my piece, I wasn't incorporating, in this instance, the audio within the work. I was taking it as, it was kind of a catalyst for my imagination. I wrote that as what the string players are going to have to do, because I believe strongly that they commit. But then what happened was it went from this sort of very imperceptible thing into these just abruptly sort of, it sort of lurches into this crazy fast stuff that you could never notate should you wish to, or at least, I mean, it's just impossible. So that what I like about this is that actually the Sample RNN, not only did it influenced the sound of this piece, but it also completely influenced the structure of it as well. Well, we can hear a bit of this now. Thank you. experience has meant that I'm now making a new piece, and it's with a solo cellist. I'm not going to say so much about it, but this new piece of the solo cellist, I'm actually incorporating the sound into the piece itself, the direct sound as well of these.
Okay, so it will be the sound from the generated music plus the one from the string quartet.
Just a solo cello pitted against Chris's ear. But I'm not going to say so much about it. I'm just saying that that's something I'm working on at the moment, and I'm really looking forward to the result. Jose Carano is an undergraduate, fourth-year undergraduate, who worked with Chris closely for a commission for the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group, working using Prism Sample or an N. And I think he was the first person to have a piece played, wasn't he? Speak, sing.
He was the first person that I really actually worked with, because I worked with him the end of August last year, so it was before I began working with Emily, actually, or anybody else. Jose was the first student to work that I worked with. I mean, he's very young, so he's a very good composer for somebody so young, writing amazing music.
I think he worked closely with Oliver Janes, who's a clarinetist with BCMG. I think he recorded Oliver improvising, actually, and then took those sounds. And I think Chris then worked, didn't you, closely sort of and put those through Sample R&N. I think we can hear it on the Prism website. We can hear a sample of it, but essentially...
We do have some samples. Working with Jose was a delight for us. First of all, he's, as I say, a very talented composer.
Could I say something about our doctoral students? So some examples, we've got Robert Laidlow. He's worked with Prism for a couple of years, and his PhD is absolutely focused on using AI in the creative process in a number of ways. He's in association with the BBC Philharmonic. And also, we talk about Zakia Leeming, who is another doctoral researcher who's worked very recently closely with Chris as part of a project for Future Music 3, led by Sam Salem and Ricardo Clement, the Machine Learning for Music Working Group that's just formed. It's a kind of collaboration between the Novar Centre at the University of Manchester with Ricardo and Prism at the RNCM with Sam Salem. I suppose, Chris, could you say something about the creative processes?
Working with Rob, he was really interested in doing some training, sample learning on an orchestral data set, which in the past we'd found quite challenging. So again, it was a case of really experimenting and finding the right parameters, which took some time. But he has a huge data set of orchestral music, you know, from right across the range from the early 18th century to right up to the present day. And perhaps we can play an example from some stuff I've done very, very recently on that data set, which is really in the last week. Really quite impressive examples there, I think. It likes a lot, as I say, it likes a lot of data. There's a huge amount of data there. I did actually write some new code for that as well. I did a little trick called weight normalization, which your listeners might like to investigate. I won't go into the gory details of that. But it helps. It seems to help in pushing the, you know, we have all these metrics that we have to measure.
But I would like to turn to David and maybe a music retrieval, because I think that's another use case for AI and machine learning in music and software. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
One of the reasons I think that music is a fantastic example of very many things is that the research community around music information retrieval, you might call it digital musicology or computational musicology, it's analysis of musical content by computer. It's a really vibrant research community. It comes together annually in an event called the Music Information Retrieval Evaluation Exchange. So listeners may be familiar with TREC. It's in information retrieval, it's a bit like that. So people come along with their algorithms, extracting features from the music. AI and machine learning is really, has over a number of years come in as the methods used in that. My own background in this, what's called in the trade, melodic pitch contours, or alternatively, query by humming. And then I wrote on structural analysis of music and actually sort of long-range dependencies of music, because AI isn't so good despite all these resources, it isn't so good at remembering what it's done. It's quite good at generating short sections of music, and not so good at the longer pieces that the humans do. So for me, structural analysis was a technique I used in digital musicology, which I'm now using again to, for example, take a piece of music and work out whether that might have been composed by the human or by the AI. That's a really, it's an interesting example. It's a compelling example. It's something that we engage with in PRISM. Rob Laidlow and Marcos de Soto have done events, sort of fantastic events, where the audience is trying to figure out which bits of the bark are real bark and which bits are fake bark. But I want to add to that, we are not trying to replace humans by machines. What we're much more interested in is a co-creative process. The human and the AI are creating together, and it's sometimes it's the disruptive effects of the AI that are influencing the music. Yeah. Rob Laidlow did a great piece with the BBC Philharmonic called Three Interstatios, a word invented by AI. One of the things we do with AI, having trained it, is prompt it, and it generates a bit of music back. So he trained the AI himself, and he used that as a prompt to the human to generate a piece of music and play it back to the AI, and so on. So this is the sort of co-creative process that we've been exploring.
Which brings me to the future, actually, of music, which in fact is also a conference, or in fact a workshop that you've been running, as you said, quite recently, despite COVID-19. I guess it was probably online, but this time it was all about AI and machine learning. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I could certainly send you to the website as well. It's on PRISM, and it's on our PRISM RNCM event, and it's called Future Music 3. As you might guess, it's our third one. This one was exploring our love of cross-disciplinary collaboration, and there was machine learning involved. There was a wonderful event that, to begin with, called Unsupervised, and this was the inaugural event for the newly formed Machine Learning for Music Working Group, ML4M. So this is a group that has been set up specifically this year, I think, by Sam Salem, who's a PRISM lecturer in composition, mm-hmm. with Ricardo Clement, who's professor of interactive music composition and director of NOVAS at the University of Manchester. And they have worked together all year, working with, I think, 8 largely doctoral students from both institutions, exploring machine learning in many ways. One of the resources was the wonderful Chris. And Chris absolutely worked with anyone who wanted to work with PRISM Sample RNN as they created their works. And I think, Chris, am I right in thinking that 5 of them worked with you? Is that right?
It was 5.
Yeah. What I thought was so stunning about this concert was the sheer variety in how distinct each of the 8 pieces were. And they had a fabulous discussion as well. So I do suggest people go and hear that.
So what's new in music? Or what's going to be the future then? So what's going to be Future of Music number 4.
Future Music 4, that would be giving the game away.
Okay, so we're not going to spill the beans, we're not going to give away the crown jewels.
Maybe just possibly tell you that.
Given that this is a research software engineer focus, perhaps I can talk very briefly and very generally.
I think so.
It comes back to what Dave touched on. I think I talked about it as well. We're modelling things, but as Dave said quite correctly, we're not modelling things in order to enable the machine to learn how to write music to replace human beings. I mean, that's not what we're about. I mean, I don't think anybody's seriously about that anyway. Serious music, serious composers are using AI in a different way, in a creative way. And they're using it, I mean, from a personal point of view, I haven't always used AI. Before I came to PRISM, I didn't use it very much. I used it a bit in the John Cage project. Yeah, I mean, I admit I was somewhat intimidated by it when I heard the DataBots, who I'd mentioned before. I mean, one of the things that you often find is that what it spits out, what these models spit out, they're kind of glitchy, they're kind of all over the place. They often don't work at all, but when they do the work, it's really kind of amazing. For me, I listen to everything. I listen to everything that it creates, but I'm really surprised by how composers that I've been working with, they really like stuff that I think is, you know, a dud, you know, that it's really not about producing a perfect replica. Using this stuff in a creative way, in a disruptive way, it kind of is in that tradition. It's not a nihilistic thing, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is an impression, I think, that a lot of people get outside of this area, that machine learning and music, AI and music, is nihilistic, but it's not. I'll just add to that is that I can't believe I get to do my hobby for money. Sorry, I have to get that in.
Yeah. Now, I would like to close now, but I think that you touched on an important point, actually, because you mentioned hobby and sort of making a living out of that. How do people actually get into it? So first of all, I think Prism is open source and people can get to it.
Yeah.
And is there actually, do you see that for the aficionados and the enthusiasts, that there is a career that they can make out of?
Well, I mean, speaking personally as a composer as well, I tried to make a career as a composer. I mean, I still compose. I am a composer, but you can't earn money writing music. Well, Emily does, but I mean, you know, most people don't. So I got into it as a kind of, I started writing music software through using it. Mm. So I suppose most people who wanted to get into it would probably be into it in some sense already. So they'd already be using some of this stuff. It's out there. The code is out there. If you want to write code, if you mm-hmm. want to contribute, you know, it's the old story. If you want to contribute to a repository, the best way to get into this area of software development anyway, you know, research software engineering, is to write lots of code.
Can I just add one final thing about the Future Music 3? Just because we focused heavily on AI and music, as we should, but also just to return to your opening conversation about music and software, just to say that the other two events, so there was Dawn on the Morning After the Storm by Zakia Leeming, and she worked closely with ISARIC. So they're the International Severe Acute Respiratory and Emerging Infection Consortium. And it was about their experience of the COVID-19 outbreak. So we had scientists all around the country speaking online, and they'd never met, but they all wanted to play music. And so Zakia is using software to put all of that together on Zoom. And that's been a very important thing, certainly this year, you know, music and software. And she's created a wonderful track involving all of them playing and then dealing with the sort of differences in pitch and the latency and all types of things. So I think that that is another use of software. And finally, to mention that we had Memo Acton, who gave a Michael Kennedy International Research Lecture, and also he made a world premiere Prism Commission, The Awesome Machinery of Nature. And Memo, he's a video and sound installation, and he is a coder. You know, it's creative coding in the most wonderful sense.
Yeah, I just have a final reflexive thought on the future coming out of our conversation. We've talked about music and AI, and we've talked about how we're using this in the creative process and how we've been interacting sort of in real time with it. If society is going to have AI so pervasively embedded as is being discussed, then we really have to understand what it means to be a creative human being in the context of that live interactive AI. And music is just a fantastic rehearsal for that. Mm. So I think what we're doing here and exploring those relationships about the creative human and the co-creating with the AI is something that transcends this immediate ambition, and I hope gives us some insights into a much broader picture.
Very nice closing remarks, David.
I hope this episode gave you a flavour of what software can do to enhance the creative processes in writing music. And being a test is how machine learning and artificial intelligence can be used in a constructive way. You'll find a wealth of information regarding the ongoing research, events, and much more on the Prism website of the Royal Northern College of Music, which you can find in the episode notes. Check it out. And with that, goodbye.